This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. The Jobs and Skills Summit is on today, and the federal government starting it with a win, securing agreement from big business group and unions on some major policy changes. The ACTU and the Business Council of Australia have reached common ground on a couple of issues, including ending the cap on permanent migration. Crucially, they're agreeing the enterprise bargaining system needs to be revamped, saying a key part of it, the so-called Better Off Overall test, or BOOT, which ensures no workers go backwards, needs to be kept but simplified. The Employment and Workplace Relations Minister is Tony Burke. Good morning, welcome. This agreement, what does that mean for the summit?
Well, it starts the day with a fair bit of momentum. We've now seen the ACTU form agreements both with small business and with big business. And the reference you made to the Better Off Overall test is a really important development, because what they've said is maintained but simplified. That makes sure that we don't have a situation where wages would go backwards, but at the same time, to try to find a way through to make the whole system less legalistic and more practical for everybody involved.
Before the summit, you'd been pretty reluctant to touch that better off overall test. Given that there's agreement now, by the end of tomorrow, do you think a deal will be in place for fixing that and overhauling the enterprise bargaining system?
Look, we'll let the session run its course at the summit, and that's this morning, the section that I'll chair where this will come up. But as I say, there's momentum there now. And from my perspective, this doesn't hit the concerns that I previously had. When the previous government wanted to touch the Better Off Overall test, it was always to suspend it, which always created a situation where every penalty rate or shift allowance could in fact be cut. That's not being put forward in this agreement. It's a proposal where workers would not go backwards, but we can potentially simplify. One of the things that's happened in the system over the last few years is it's become much, much more legalistic and complex and difficult to navigate. And if we can address those issues that are raised in the agreement that I suspect will get a fair bit of support in the summit today, then we'll be well on the way to getting agreement-making moving. And if you've got agreements moving, you've got wages moving.
Business and unions have also agreed that paid parental leave should be extended to 26 weeks and super paid on top of that. So will the government now adopt that?
There'll be lots of good ideas that'll come out. A lot of them won't hit my portfolio, but what you can work on the basis is two things. Good ideas always have their place in planning, but everything that hits a budget bottom line, there will be things that we want to do that we can't afford to do. That's one of the things that is a reality when you're dealing with more than $1 trillion of Liberal debt.
There's already agreement about the need to lift skilled migration and an immediate review of the skills on the list. When will the government release the details on the size of the increase in migrants and what jobs are going to be on that skills list now?
Yeah, once again, on the specifics of that, you're in Claire O'Neill and Andrew Giles areas, but the normal time that the information with respect to total immigration numbers is released as normally as part of the budget process. There may well be further indications that are given depending on how those sessions go during the course of the summit.
All right. What consideration will go into how those workers will be accommodated? You know, potentially, we're talking 40,000 more workers additional each year. Given that Australians are struggling right now to find affordable rentals and health services, what's the government thinking about that?
Yeah, can I raise two issues with respect to this, Sabra? First of all, we did come to office with a very significant housing program, both in terms of trying to help people get into the housing market, but also increasing the total supply of housing, particularly social housing and affordable housing. So those policies are critical here. The other thing with the conversation about immigration, and there's a conversation about, you know, people who've retired, we also need to remember the people of what's normally regarded as working age who want to be in the workforce and are having trouble getting in. that goes specifically to people with disability. And also there was a roundtable that I convened a couple of days ago on older workers. There's a very large number of people still in their 40s, their 50s and their 60s who may have been retrenched and have found it very difficult to find their way back into the workforce. It's particularly difficult if you look at the stats for women. It particularly goes to people who might not have had further education. But it's across the board. And what I'd encourage all businesses to consider is for the different levers that might be available for additional workers to come to Australia, don't forget the people who are already here and are wanting to work that often get overlooked.
Well, you say that, but businesses are reluctant to take on older people. How do you break down that barrier?
Oh, and I at the roundtable, there were a few issues that were specifically put on this. Some of this is just sitting down directly with business organisations and saying, what are the particular skills that you have a problem with here that you want us to skill up? And then for me to use my capacity as Employment Minister and Brendan O'Connor's role as responsibility for skills and training to see how we can help there. And it's just where in the conversation about people who are not in Australia or not viewed as being ordinarily of working age, which is where most of the focus has gone, I just want to make sure we don't lose sight of these individuals.
All right. Employment and Workplace Relations Minister Tony Burke, thanks for talking to AM.
Great to talk to you.
Some of the last COVID restrictions, are easing. Federal, state and territory leaders have agreed to shorten mandatory isolation, reduce mask-wearing recommendations and alter pandemic payments. The changes will come into force from Friday next week, and while business groups are hoping it'll mean more people at work, medical experts are concerned we could be heading for another COVID wave. Political reporter Dana Morse has the story.
It's been whispered about for months, and now a change is in sight. From next Friday, mandatory COVID isolation will be reduced from 7 to 5 days if people have no symptoms. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says the time is right.
I believe, and First Ministers agreed, that on the weight of evidence, this was a proportionate response at this point in the pandemic.
The 7-day isolation period will remain in high-risk settings like aged care homes and disability care centres. Chief Executive for the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, Andrew McKellar, says shortening the isolation period will make a big difference to workforce levels.
We're struggling to keep people at work, so I think anything that improves the flexibility there will certainly be positively received.
Also up for consideration is the $750 isolation payment. The new amount is yet to be settled, but it's likely to drop by around $200. It was scheduled to finish at the end of September, but the PM now says that's up for discussion.
We haven't changed the arrangements with regard to payments. We'll have a meeting about that in a couple of weeks' time.
And with mask wearing on domestic flights also dropped, health experts are urging caution. Professor Steve Robson is the president of the Australian Medical Association.
We'll be watching very closely at how this plays out in terms of pressure on hospitals, and we'll be calling on the government to look to revise that if we find that things are getting worse.
He says the government should learn the lessons of shorter isolation periods from overseas.
I think a lot of what we've seen from overseas is literally catastrophic, so I wouldn't be hitching my wagon to that star too early.
Professor Julie Leask is a public health expert from the University of Sydney. She says it's a matter of weighing up the risks.
What proportion of people with Omicron are likely to transmit that virus between the 5 and 7 day period? And are the gains that we get from reducing isolation period worth that cost in the potential for slightly more transmission?
She says the government should release the health advice behind the change.
Clearly, there are going to be people who are very concerned about the signal value of this, and that's why having clear, transparent health advice behind this change is very important for the community. And coming clean with the community about what sort of trade-offs were considered in that decision-making is important for sustaining public trust.
Trust that has been tested in the past 2.5 years.
Dana Morse reporting. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's met Australia's Defence Minister and Deputy PM Richard Marles and shown off his country's latest nuclear submarine. Australian submariners will train on the British subs, but the government in Canberra is yet to decide which model it'll choose for Australia's nuclear submarine program. Europe correspondent Nick Dole reports.
In his final few days in the top job, Boris Johnson's basking in his Navy's latest success. HMS Anson is the latest of Britain's astute class of nuclear submarines. There'll be seven built in total.
And you're looking, by the way, at a vessel that is five times as long as the Chamber of the House of Commons, and I think you will agree, as an international argument, considerably more persuasive than some of the things that are deployed in the chamber.
Boris Johnson doesn't need to persuade the Australian government about the merits of nuclear subs. As part of the AUKUS deal to match a more assertive China, the previous federal government decided to scrap a contract with France and pursue nuclear-powered submarines using US and UK technology. But Australia's still choosing a design. The UK's Astute class is one option and the United States' Virginia class is another. The UK's Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, said it shouldn't be an either-or decision.
Is it buying an American one off the shelf or one of these ones off the shelf? It's not that. AUKUS is a collaborative programme between three nations. There's a confusion that somehow, you know, this is me trying to sell that submarine, and it may look like a submarine that none of us have on our stocks, fully shared with all three nations as a collaborative design.
Any Australian-built nuclear sub is unlikely to be in the water before the 2040s, but the existing Collins-class submarine won't last past the mid-30s. So, will Britain or the US give Australia one of the subs they're producing already? It's looking unlikely.
Both industries are at capacity, and there's a surging demand for nuclear attack submarines both in London and DC. So, building an additional submarine for Australia is probably not likely in the near future.
That's Brent Sadler, a former submariner and analyst from the Heritage Foundation. He says it's much more likely a country like the UK would send its subs to Australia for an extended period.
If you home port British and American submarines, nuclear submarines, in, say, Perth, which is not a new idea, by the way, it goes back decades, and those submarines actually start a veil of positions on board for Australian sailors and officers to train on the nuclear operations.
Even though Australia's still choosing a design, Defence Minister Richard Marles says the training has begun. Britain's agreed to host Australian submariners here in the UK, so they're prepared for whatever comes next.
So we have no time to waste. And that's why in thinking through the decision that we need to make about which submarine we run with and how we can get that hardware in place as soon as possible, we also need to be thinking through how we get the human equation right as well.
The government's due to make its decision on the future direction of the submarine program in March next year. This is Nick Dole in Barrow-in-Furness reporting for AM.
It's the billion-dollar industry that's been plagued by botched surgery, hygiene issues and questionable conduct. Now the cosmetic surgery sector's in for a shake-up, with the medical regulator accepting all the recommendations from a lengthy investigation. But leading plastic surgeons are describing the proposed changes as profoundly disappointing, saying they'll do little to improve patient safety. Penny Timms from the specialist reporting team has more.
Sunshine Coast woman Celia Brady vividly remembers going under the knife for a breast augmentation 13 years ago. She says she wasn't properly sedated.
I was awake for my whole procedure, but I couldn't speak. I remember everything. I remember feeling the incision. I remember wanting to scream and to tell them to stop because I could feel it.
She still carries the scars today and wants better protections in place for consumers.
When you are a young person looking to make such a major change to your body, it is vital that you can trust that the healthcare professionals and providers are regulated.
The medical board and the national regulator APRA also say they want to improve patient safety, following a review by the former Queensland Health Ombudsman, Andrew Brown. APRA's chief executive is Martin Fletcher.
Both APRA and the Medical Board of Australia welcome your report and accept all of the recommendations in full.
Those recommendations include the creation of a cosmetic surgery enforcement unit inside APRA, a confidential cosmetic surgery hotline, an endorsement pathway for cosmetic surgery training so prospective patients can better identify what level of training their doctor has, banning testimonials for cosmetic surgeons, and a complaints committee. The president of the Australian Society of Plastic Surgeons is Associate Professor Nicola Dean.
Unfortunately, although the intention may have been good, these recommendations are really inadequate for meeting the needs of the community and really won't achieve what's needed in this area.
Professor Mark Ashton is a past president of the same group and has been a vocal critic of the cosmetic surgery industry.
Overall, I felt the report was underwhelming and profoundly disappointing. I say that because it will do little, if anything, to clean up and protect the public from undertrained or poorly trained medical practitioners who at the moment are running rampant in our community, harming and maiming people on a daily and weekly basis.
Anyone with a medical licence can perform cosmetic procedures. Plastic surgeons want restrictions on who can perform surgeries in the first place. Andrew Brown, who headed up the review, says it's not that simple.
That would take legislative amendment. That is a very complicated process because it's a national law and it has to be passed through every state and territory in the country.
That doesn't sit well with Associate Professor Nicola Dean.
If it needs a change in the national law, then why are APRA not asking for this? And why are they not working hand in hand with other regulatory bodies? They certainly have made efforts to work across the important bodies in Australia, but if it needs a change in the national law, then that's what they should be calling for.
But even though this billion-dollar industry delivers an estimated 500,000 cosmetic surgery procedures a year, it's unclear when the changes will come into effect.
Penny Timms reporting. Shoppers in Queensland might have noticed a major retailer is now putting deodorant spray cans in glass security cabinets. Many Woolworths stores are locking up the aerosols to stop them being stolen in an attempt to curb a potentially deadly substance abuse known as chroming. Medical experts have compared it with melting your brain. Lily Nothling reports.
Sitting in a Townsville park, Maverick Massey is flooded with memories of his son Brian.
He was a happy-go-lucky little boy. He had a lot of friends. He had good friends and bad friends. I think he went down the wrong path with the bad friends.
In 2017, the 13-year-old was found dead just a few hundred metres from home. He'd been inhaling toxic chemical fumes from spray cans of deodorants in search of a high. It's a dangerous practice known as chroming.
I heard an ambulance siren and then I wasn't thinking so much about it until somebody rang me then and told me that they found Brian in the park. I had to go to the police station to identify his body.
Chroming is a serious public health issue and disproportionately impacts Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people.
We've had at least 10 deaths in the past 4 or 5 years that we know of nationally and probably many, many others.
That's Genevieve Sinclair, the Chief Executive of Youth Empowered Towards Independence, a CANS-based support service.
We're currently experiencing quite a sizeable outbreak of deodorant sniffing in cans itself. At the moment, the numbers are certainly the highest we've experienced in the last 2 or 3 years.
Associate Professor Luke Lawton works at the emergency department at the Townsville University Hospital. He says every case is a concern.
A great way of describing chroming is it melts your brain. So both from a short and a long-term perspective, it's a devastating activity to undertake for that young person, but also with a ripple effect down into their family, the community and the healthcare system more broadly.
To combat chroming, supermarket giant Woolworths has been installing locked glass cabinets in the aisles of some Queensland stores. The trial began in the Northern Territory and the northwest Queensland town of Mount Isa last year and has now been extended to almost 30 supermarkets, including in Cairns, Townsville, Logan and the Gold Coast. Genevieve Sinclair has applauded the move.
Young people, when they can't obtain deodorant at a store, can separate and move on and decide to do other things that aren't as dangerous.
But she's also calling for more funding for youth drug and alcohol initiatives and services to support vulnerable young people.
Because often the issue is not about the drug, about the inhalant, but it's all those things that are going on for young people. Their access to school, what's happening at home, the current homelessness crisis. There's a whole lot of work to be done in our social system to stop young people kind of reaching the point where they're making these really unhealthy choices.
CANS support worker Genevieve Sinclair ending Lily Nothling's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Business wants more workers, unions want more money for workers. But can the job summit at Parliament House deliver both? Today, Alan Kohler on whether the Talkfest can actually bring about the change the economy needs. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.